When I travel to these mega churches, they are completely isolated from the community that they exist in. They don't reach out to other denominations. They don't reach out to the public schools. They could care less about the local officials. The only two groups they ever reach out to are law enforcement and the military. And that was a pattern that I kept seeing repeated in mega church after mega church after mega church. U.S. Marine Corps Appreciation Day, State Trooper Sunday. And they would bring these people in and laud them for their Christian probity. And they know very well what they're doing. That those forces of coercion within a society are absolutely fundamental if any radical movement is going to succeed.
That's Chris Hedges, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Chris Hedges on American Fascists, the Radical Christian Right. Over the last several decades, there has been a growth in fascist ayatollahs and mullahs in the United States. Not content with limiting themselves to religious matters, these holy rollers use their extensive media networks to expound on political issues. For example, Pat Robertson called for the United States to take out Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. He's a terrific danger whose country, says Reverend Pat, is a launching pad for communist infiltration and Islamic extremism. Imagine that. Robertson suffered no opprobrium or penalty, and he still hosts his nightly 700 Club TV show. So it's cool to advocate the assassination of an elected head of state. But Pat's small potatoes compared to the grand vision of televangelist John Hagee. Pastor Hagee says, the United States must join Israel in a preemptive military strike against Iran to fulfill God's plan for both Israel and the West. A biblically prophesized end-time confrontation with Iran, which will lead to the rapture and the second coming of Christ. To talk about American fascists and the radical Christian right is Chris Hedges. He reported for the New York Times for more than a decade. Before that, he worked for the Christian Science Monitor and National Public Radio. He's covered wars in the Balkans, the Middle East, and Central America. His book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, received the 2003 Overseas Press Club Award. His latest book is American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. He spoke at the Boulder Bookstore in Boulder, Colorado on January 22, 2007.
I come out of the church. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother also went to seminary, although she became a college professor. I grew up in a small farm town in upstate New York, literally right next to the church where my father was the minister. It was a poor, a very poor county, Schoharie County, and he actually had five churches. And on Sunday mornings, he would consolidate two of the services, but he would get up early, and I'd often go with him and hear him preach the same sermon three times and travel in the car with him and ask him. So at a very early age, I began getting indoctrinated with Christian theology. And I think that coming out of this tradition is important for a couple reasons. One, I'm not Sam Harris. I don't believe that religion is the cause of all evil in the world. And Sam and I have gone back and forth on this, and I think Truthdig, if anyone knows that website, is going to try and set up a debate with us in Berkeley in the spring. I have just as bleak a view of human nature and the moral neutrality of the universe as Sam. However, I also have a very bleak view of human institutions. All institutions, the theologian Paul Tillich said, are inherently demonic. And that includes the church, which anybody who's read the history of the Christian church doesn't need me to explain the bloodbaths and inquisitions and totalitarian terror that's been propagated in the name of religion. But been propagated in the name of religion, and of course, in my feeling, the misuse of religion. You know, when Sam and I went back and forth, one of the things he said was, well, do you really believe that if We didn't have these religious ideologies. These genocidal campaigns and fanaticism would exist. And I said, yes, read Freud. You know, there is something endemic and dark within human nature. I certainly saw it for the some 2 decades I spent as a war correspondent, and I chronicled, I think, this enticement and a lure of violence. That, you know, ability. We used to say in a war zone, give a teenage kid an automatic weapon, and in 4 days they become God. And if they don't wrap that, and many times they do, of course, wrap it around a religious ideology, but when it's not wrapped around a religious ideology, it can be wrapped around nationalism or communism or any other ideology which claims to be propelled forward either through history or divine right towards a utopian end, and of course embraces that specter of apocalyptic violence, that belief that violence can be used to cleanse the earth, cleanse the society, and make it pure and whole. So I came at this movement as one in no way predisposed against the Christian religion, and in fact, somebody I think who's been deeply formed and continues to be informed by the Christian faith, with all of that distaste that I have for religious institutions, including Christian institutions. Certainly covering the wars in Yugoslavia, the stance of the Serbian Orthodox Church or the Catholic Church in Croatia was reprehensible. They wrapped themselves around these nationalist causes. They sanctified campaigns of genocide. They gave it a religious legitimacy. They allowed religious iconography, religious ritual, and religious language to be used to propagate the murder of innocents. There are a couple things that happened that go into the genesis of this book, American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. The first comes as a student at Harvard Divinity School. I was living in Roxbury, in the ghetto in Boston, in the Mission, across the street from the Mission Main, Mission Extension Housing Project, where for 2.5 years I ran a church as a student minister. And that was a very troubling period for me for 2 reasons. One, I had to confront the fact that I was a Presbyterian, that the church that I came from had walked out on the poor with white flight, that they were no longer in the inner city. And coupled with that came the liberal theology of Harvard Divinity School. And somebody asked me the other day how I got from Harvard Divinity School to the New York Times, and I said it was a very easy transition from one godless institution to another. At Harvard, they all spoke on behalf of the oppressed. They all wanted to go out and empower the poor. But this was in the abstract, in the same way that the liberal church wanted to empower the poor in the abstract, from Newton, Massachusetts, not from the inner city. And the 2 years that I spent, and I preached every Sunday, I couldn't do the sacraments, I had the status of a deacon as a seminarian, but I could do funerals, I did 7 funerals, and the distaste that I had for the rhetoric of the liberal church and for liberal institutions like Harvard grew every day as I commuted in from the Green Line on the Green Line into Cambridge and came back at night to the despair of the projects. I remember, you know, for someone who grew up in a fairly cloistered environment, there was rural poverty where I grew up, but it was really nothing like urban poverty, the violence of urban poverty. And it really took living in the ghetto to understand how oppression is institutionalized in urban ghettos and how those who are poor, how difficult it is to escape. All of the forces that combine, probation officers, schools that don't work, banks that redline, all of these forces converge to keep the poor poor. Now, my great mentor at Harvard was this exceptional character named Dr. James Luther Adams, who, when I had him, he was almost 80. He taught ethics, and he told us that when we were his age, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. And that warning came at the very time that Pat Robertson and others began articulating a new political religion, one that was a radical break from traditional American fundamentalism and American evangelicalism. This tradition talked about the assumption of political power. It used a verse from Genesis about dominion, that Christians had been given dominion by God to control America and ultimately to create a global Christian empire. At the time, it was hard to take such fantastic rhetoric by Adams seriously. But Adams warned us against our intellectual snobbery that oftentimes allowed us to dismiss these characters as buffoonish. He told us that the Nazis were not going to return or reincarnate in America with swastikas and brown shirts, but that their ideological inheritors had found a mask for fascism in the pages of the Bible and by co-opting the language and iconography of American patriotism. Adams was not a person to use the word fascist lightly. He had been in Germany in 1935, in 1936, where he had worked with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Martin Niemöller, in the underground confessing church, and he was eventually detained by the Gestapo and forced to leave the country. But it was an experience that marked him deeply. And he was, of course, sensitive in ways that we were not to the elements that go into making up movements that at their core are totalitarian and seek in the name of a utopian exclusivity of the right to control a country. I left shortly after this for El Salvador. I was pretty much out of the country for 2 decades. So that distance allowed me to come back 2 decades later. And the difference between where these figures were when I left and where they had come to now when I returned was, of course, quite striking, because it may have been a gradual process, but for somebody juxtaposing American society in 1983 and American society in the year 2000, the differences, of course, were vast. These figures had moved from the fringes of American society, from the very margins of American society, into the mainstream. They counted, according to groups like Eagle Forum, Family Resource Council, I think 186 members of the House of Representatives, this is before the 2006 elections, had between 80 to 100% approval rating by these hard-right radical Christian groups. There were 45 senators who approved this rating. President Bush had begun handing hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to these groups. He had destroyed federal agencies that dealt with science, whether it was in areas of global warming, whether it was areas of reproductive health, whether it was AIDS research, and the distance that these people had traveled in the span of 2 decades was so stark that, and Adams, of course, warning came back to me, that I decided to set out and spend what ended up being 2 years following this movement. And I traveled all over the country, from megachurches to pro-life rallies to, I spent a week with D. James Kennedy at Coral Ridge taking his course called Evangelism Explosion, which certifies me to carry out 20-minute conversions, so we can do that after the... To what? In D. James Kennedy calls it recruitment. It's the word that he uses. It's not simply conversion, it's recruitment into a movement. One of the great things about being a reporter is that oftentimes you carry assumptions into stories that are shattered. And I often find that, is sometimes what separates, good reporters from academics who can write their treatises without ever having anything impinge upon their assumptions. And I carried assumptions into this work that were wrong. And I'll share with you the first one. I have such a deep distaste for the ideology of the movement, that I was honestly prepared to dislike a lot of the people within it. And I have to say that that didn't happen. In fact, the stories that I heard from, I'm talking about the followers of this movement, the people who send money, love offerings into TBN to Paul and Jan Crouch, or money to James Dobson, or any of these figures, were so earnest and often well-meaning. And when I interviewed them, the stories of their lives were so heartbreaking. I didn't put it in the book, but repeatedly I would interview women within the movement, and for instance, at a pro-life weekend. And one of the fascinating things, by the way, about a lot of the radical or most committed members of the pro-life movement I found with women is that not only had they had abortions, many of them have had multiple abortions. And the way the movement quite effectively manipulates their shame and their guilt, I found to be deeply cruel. They will take them off on weekends. I think it's called Rachel's Vineyard. And they give them dolls. And they tell them these are the children that they have murdered. And they must carry these dolls with them for the entire weekend and sleep with the dolls and clothe them. And at the end of the weekend, and these are women already struggling, you know, abortion is probably one of many things they're struggling with. They must offer up their children that they have killed to God and beg for forgiveness and commit themselves to fighting what is termed the culture of death. These stories, when you hear them, are so overpowering and so sad that it became very hard for me to dislike almost anyone. I'm talking about the followers, not the leaders. I find people like James Dobson, I find him a frightening and very dangerous figure. But the followers themselves have been manipulated and used in, I think, an extremely callous and heartless manner. And it was listening to these stories that pushed me back to some of the people like Fritz Stern or Karl Popper or Hannah Arendt, who tried to make sense of how a civilization like Germany, a civilization that produced Goethe to Beethoven, could end up carrying out the horror that it unleashed under the Nazi regime. And one of the books that I think helped me grasp what was going on in the Christian right was a book by Fritz Stern called The Politics of Cultural Despair. And Stern, when he himself was a Jewish refugee, he left in the late 1930s as a young boy. I ended up actually reading the book and spending a lot of time with Fritz, who's an amazingly thoughtful man, and has also spoken out, by the way, against the Christian right in terms that have shocked a lot of people. And all of his academic work was pre-1933, before the Nazis actually took power. And in the book, The Politics of Cultural Despair, he targets what he sees as personal and economic despair as being the engine that allowed people to eventually become sucked into this totalitarian, this fanaticism, this movement. He said to me, in Germany, in the beginning of the 20th century, there was a yearning for fascism before the word fascism was invented. And that was extremely instructive to me, because I think that what's happened in the United States does bear many similarities to the breakdown of society in Germany or the breakdown of society in Yugoslavia. I covered the war in Yugoslavia for 3 years. Many people talk about the war in Yugoslavia as being caused by ancient ethnic hatreds. The war in Yugoslavia was caused not by ancient ethnic hatreds, but by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was the country in Eastern Europe best equipped to enter Europe. And it even had within its ranks one of the great East European dissidents, certainly Václav Havel's equal, and that was Milovan Žilas. But of course, the mutation of the society had them turn to Slobodan Milosevic, who Žilas wrote about the inheritors of this and called them moral pygmies. And I found the more I listen to these stories of followers within the movement, that their lives had sunk to such a level of despair and brokenness that they could no longer cope with the real world, with that there are now, I believe, tens of millions of people within this country, and certainly anyone who has spent time in Ohio is aware of this, who have been completely dispossessed, disenfranchised. If you visit areas around the Rust Belt, these towns look like the developing world. The streets are potholed, the houses are crumbling, the schools are dysfunctional, the downtown stores are boarded up, and the great hulking dinosaurs, rusting hulks of factories lie broken and unused. And with that, of course, has brought all of the ills that comes when communities break down. Domestic abuse, struggles with alcoholism, broken families, and coupled with this flight of manufacturing jobs, and of course they've not been replaced. I mean, steel workers, or, you know, instead of making $50 an hour with benefits, people are suddenly making $16 an hour without benefits in places like Walmart, if they can even make $16. And of course, both spouses have to work. There's no future among the working class that their children will be able to get any kind of job or have any kind of future that will even equal the one that they used to have. And that kind of Weimarization of the American working class has thrust these people, of course, first into despair, but ultimately propel them into rage. And I think if you listen closely to right-wing talk radio, the popularity of it is that it's an expression of this rage. The message is, you know, America used to be a great place, but then all those liberals and immigrants and homosexuals and feminists came and took it away from you, and we're going to get it back. That's the fundamental message of like a Rush Limbaugh or an O'Reilly or any of these people. And that's deeply attractive. I know that the book Thomas Franks wrote talks about these people voting or against their interests. I have a slightly different take on that. I think the Democratic Party walked out on these people a long time ago. You know, NAFTA was given to us not by a Republican administration, but by Bill Clinton. The end of welfare was handed to the American people by the Clinton administration. The deregulation of the FCC, which is not a small phenomena, was handed to us by the Clinton administration. And the anger towards liberals, which is real, I don't think is misplaced. Because just as I had to deal with the hypocrisy of the liberal church, which felt that it would speak on behalf of the poor, they have to deal with the Democratic Party, which traditionally protected their interest, stopped protecting their interest once they realized they could get the same funding that the Republican Party could, but continued to speak as if they were protecting their interests. And half of my family comes from small mill towns in Maine, so this has a kind of personal element to it. I think that anger towards liberals is not wrong. I think that they were betrayed, that they've been betrayed by all of us. And what has happened? What's happened is what usually happens when in a society where you have a huge segment of that society dispossessed. People increasingly can't cope with the real world. There's less and less assistance, on federal assistance, state assistance, community support for them to cope with the real world. And so they are ushered easily by demagogues, which is what a figure like Pat Robertson is, into a non-reality-based belief system, into a world of magic, into a world where God has a plan for them. And Jesus intervenes several times a day in their life. And God will not only protect them, but make them successful. And once they've been ushered into this non-reality-based belief system, once they embrace a world of magic, they embrace a world that is essentially irrational. They become unreachable.
You're listening to Chris Hedges on American Fascists, the Radical Christian Right. This is AR. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And I think one of the most pernicious and dangerous things that we as a society have allowed to happen is the creation of these hermetic information systems, Christian radio and broadcasting, that indoctrinates these people on a 24-hour basis. And everything that they hear or see, whether it's news, entertainment, health and beauty tips, spiritual guidance, comes through this ideological prism. This world where lies are true, where facts are interchangeable with opinions. And that, of course, is what creationism is about. Creationism is not about an alternative. It's not about presenting another side. There is no other side to evolution. America is the only industrialized nation in the world that raises questions about the validity of evolution. What this is about the destruction of dispassionate, honest, intellectual inquiry. It's about the destruction of science. It is about creating within the mainstream a belief in magic. It is about removing people from a reality-based world and ushering them into a world where people can believe whatever they want to believe. And I'm going to read you a small section of Hannah Arendt's Origin of Totalitarianism that I used to begin the chapter on creationism called The War on Truth. Before they seize power and establish a world according to their doctrines, totalitarian movements conjure up a lying world of consistency, which is more adequate to the needs of the human mind than reality itself, in which, through sheer imagination, uprooted masses can feel at home and are spared the never-ending shocks which real life and real experiences deal to human beings and their expectations. The force possessed by totalitarian propaganda, before the movements have the power to drop iron curtains to prevent anyone's disturbing, by the slightest reality, the gruesome quiet of an entirely imaginary world, lies in its ability to shut the masses off from the real world. This is the phenomena of creationism. This is the phenomena of dominionism, or the ideology that is being foisted upon this country by the radical Christian white. I, of course, don't give this movement religious legitimacy, however earnest, however well-meaning and decent many of the followers are, because I look at them as being manipulated by very callous, cold, and sophisticated demagogues like James Dobson, who have figured out that by manipulating people's despair, they can not only get rich, but they can get powerful. And I think that it's important for those of us who care about our open society and who want to fight to protect our democracy that we make this distinction between those people who are being used by this movement and those figures at the top of the movement like Pat Robertson, who have tapped into this despair, understood it, and used it for deeply nefarious and dark ends. All of you should take time to listen to Christian radio and broadcasting. It's deeply disturbing. The ideology it promotes is one in which people like me have no place in this society. One of the arguments, and I think you see it within segments of the Democratic Party, is that there should be an effort to reach out to this movement and engage in a dialogue with it to try and bring evangelicals, of which there are 80 to 100 million in this country, back into the Democratic fold. I think this is a disastrous mistake for this reason. When you deal with a movement whose leaders preach that there are only two acceptable ways of being. Either conversion, which of course means submission to their authority and their ideological belief system, or extinction, because that is what they're saying, then there is no room for a dialogue. All dialogue must include mutual respect, the recognition that there are other ways to be, other ways to believe, other faiths that have validity, including faiths outside the nation. When that mutual respect is abolished, when the discussion between you and an adversary is only about your submission, or ultimately, of course, eradication in this obsession with apocalyptic violence, which really is a manifestation of the kind of rage that many of these people feel, this theology of despair, because that's what this is. It's not, which should be the heart of the Christian gospel, it's not a theology of hope or love. It's a theology which says nothing in this world is worth saving and worth protecting, and therefore everything should be destroyed, including all of those people on the planet that have not bought into my belief system. And the language, and some of it's in the book, of the many of the people, like Rod Parsley is a good example, is one that's constantly filled with the language of violence and the language of war. And I think that when you look at like the Left Behind series or any of the long descriptions of what happens at the end times, there's a deep pornographic quality to the violence that is poured out. And of course, what happens in totalitarian systems is that you surrender your conscience. Moral decisions are made for you. You are told what is right, what is wrong. That's part of the attractiveness of totalitarian movements. You remove that anxiety, and you are given a moral license by demagogues to hate and to destroy certain segments. You can direct that rage and hatred and kill with a free conscience. And you see it the way they talk about Muslims. And there's also, I went to a weekend with Tim LaHaye in Detroit, and in which, you know, they brand the religion of Islam as satanic, as something that must be abolished from the face of the earth. And that binary worldview, that ability to hand to believers the right to kill, is one that's deeply intoxicating, and of course is one of the attractiveness not only of this movement, but of all despotic or totalitarian movements. It was one of the things that I saw Slobodan Milosevic use to great effectiveness with crowds in Belgrade. So how does one handle a movement like this? How does one deal as we watch this movement rise within our society? I'm going to read just one little more passage from Karl Popper, who writes about this in his book, The Open Society and Its Enemies. Popper himself, like Hannah Arendt, like Fritz Stern, Popper was Viennese. He fled during the Second World War and wrote, you know, not only this great sort of scholarly work, but like Arendt, combined with the passion of somebody who understood how these movements work in a very visceral way, and of course suffered. Many of his own family members were killed in the Holocaust. He writes about tolerance, and Popper has this wonderful term. He calls it the paradox of tolerance. He says, unlimited tolerance must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance, even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. In this formulation, I do not imply, for instance, that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies as long as we can counter them by rational argument and keep them in check by public opinion. Suppression would certainly be most unwise. But we should claim the right to suppress them, if necessary, even by force, for it may easily turn out that they are not prepared to meet us on the level of rational argument, but begin by denouncing all argument. They may forbid their followers to listen to rational argument. because it is deceptive, and teach them to answer arguments by the use of their fists or pistols. We should therefore claim in the name of tolerance the right not to tolerate the intolerant. We should claim that any movement preaching intolerance places itself outside the law, and we should consider incitement to intolerance and persecution as criminal. In the same way as we should consider incitement to murder or to kidnapping or to the revival of the slave trade as criminal. And so what do we do? If I'm correct, if the root of this movement lies in the dislocation or disenfranchisement of tens of millions of Americans, the physical destruction of community, and when one looks at the two epicenters of the movement, it comes from these blighted former manufacturing centers and these huge soulless exurbs like Orange County, where there's no community center, no community rituals, often no sidewalks, and people live in vast palladium-windowed monstrosities and get in big empty cars and drive 2 hours to big empty offices in LA and come home again. I think that physical destruction of community and the despair that it engenders, often economic, but not always, have been the engines of this movement. And unfortunately, there's no check now on the growth of America's oligarchy. We currently live in a country where the top 1% control more wealth than the 90% of households combined. And democracies cannot survive with these kinds of disparities and inequities. And that's not a new thought. Plutarch wrote about it. Thucydides wrote about it. We must find a way to reincorporate these people back into American society, to give them hope. If they continue to live on the margins of American society, if we continue to allow the assaults on the American working class to now reach out to the American professional class, and of course anything that can be put on software today can be outsourced, which means that engineering, architecture, a host of technical fields can be handed off to professional sweatshops in India where workers will work without benefits and, of course, at a third of the wages of American society. Unless we begin to stand up against these forces, then I think there is finally no way to blunt this movement. There are certainly things that we can do, passing hate crimes legislation. Look at everything they're fighting against. They are working very hard to make it impossible to have hate crimes legislation as we have in Canada, because they know that it can be applied to them in the kind of filth that they spew over the radio and broadcasting about a host of American citizens, starting with gays and lesbians. You know, one of the things Adams told us when I was in seminary was that we should watch very closely to what this movement did towards gays and lesbians. Because the first decree that Hitler passed in 1933, after he took power at the end of January, was banning all gay and lesbian meeting places. And one of the first book burnings that he carried out was in May at the Berlin Sexual Institute. And this drive to clean up the filth of Weimar Germany, to restore moral order, to bring back traditional German values, were lauded and cheered not only by the majority of the German public, but by the German churches as well. And Adams said that that process of stripping citizens of their rights because of their sexual orientation, of singling out social deviance, people labeled as social deviance, was part of the march towards our door, because they have a long list of social deviants. And we would be very naive to believe that they intend to stop with gays and lesbians, because when they're finished with them, they will turn on women, on scholars, on artists, on scientists. There is a host of people that they are ready to destroy. And so for me, that battle, and unfortunately it's a battle we're losing, to protect the rights of gays and lesbians in this country is that canary in the cage, that tocsin bell that should be ringing and warning all of us that when they finish with them, they're going to come through the door for us. So I believe that while hate crimes legislation is important, while efforts to challenge the use of airwaves to funnel messages of hatred and violence is something that should be campaigned against within the society. Finally, we will only break this movement by reaching out, as we did in the 1930s, to millions of Americans who were dispossessed and bringing them back into our society. That, of course, is the great gift of the New Deal. It saved us from American corporatism, which, of course, corporatism is a term that comes from Mussolini's fascist state. It's why Fortune magazine in 1934 put Mussolini on its cover and praised him for the empowerment of Italian industrialists at the expense of Italian workers, and it's why there was a huge flirtation in the 1930s with fascism by American conservatives and American corporate interests. And of course, what we have seen, and Robert O. Paxton writes about this in his book, Anatomy of Fascism. He says there is no such thing as a purely fascist movement, unlike communism. Fascists always make uneasy alliances with conservative or corporate interests. And that's precisely what the Christian right has done. It's why Tyson Foods or DeVore's or many of these groups that have been gathered together by people like Tim LaHaye are so willing to fund this movement. Because if you remove people from a reality-based world, it's so much easier to rape them and take away absolutely everything they have in their life that can protect them. Because, of course, what's held up in front of them is this mirage that God is going to save them. And I think that that alliance has now gone extremely far and become extremely effective and a very potent and dangerous political force in American society. Finally, let me conclude by saying that none of these movements can come to power unless there is a prolonged period of instability or crisis. And we're not in a period of crisis now. But should we suffer another catastrophic terrorist attack? Should we have an economic meltdown? Should we suffer a series of environmental disasters? Then I think these groups stand poised to manipulate our fear, promise us security, safety, and protection, of course, if we will turn over their rights, and move to reshape American society in ways that have probably not been seen since our nation's founding. Thank you very much. He's asking how can these groups deal with or counter Jesus' message about the poor, about rendering unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, Jesus constantly inveighed against violence, the use of violence. I think that one of the things that gives me a kind of window into the movement is because I know the Bible so well, I'm a little more attuned to how they distort it. And when you watch how they distort it and what parts of the Bible they pick out and what parts they ignore, because there are certainly hateful messages in the Bible. There are passages in the Hebrew Bible where God appears to countenance even bless genocide. The Gospel of John has anti-Semitic statements in it. Paul denounces homosexuality, also promotes slavery as an institution. But it's what they ignore and what they pick out that exposes who they are. And that gross misuse of the Bible is such... I'm just going to give a little example to show that in a minute. That gross misuse is a huge tip-off as to what it is they're trying to promote. When you know the Bible and you know how they edit it to fit their ideology. I mean, they often talk about acculturating America to the Christian religion, but a fact, of course, the opposite has happened. They have acculturated the Christian religion with the worst of American imperialism and American capitalism. And that distortion of the Bible, for me, essentially means they're heretics. I look at them as heretics. You know, it is just absolutely inconceivable that one can read through the Greek Bible and believe that God wants us all to have huge cars and Learjets and lots of money. It's absolutely inconceivable. And so they present themselves as literalists, but of course they're not literalists. They're selective literalists. Do they believe, as it says in the Hebrew Bible, that the vault of night sky above us are all the little lights are peepholes with God looking down on us? I mean, there's so much stuff in the Bible that is so fantastic that they discard. And there are so many passages like the Sermon on the Mount that they have no use for, that it becomes very clear that they're about something else. I attended a creation seminar run by these ideologues to teach teachers in Christian schools how to teach about creation. And I think it's in the details that the irrationality of their belief system becomes apparent. Because, of course, what happens in Genesis is that God creates light on the first day and the sun on the fourth day. And so how the instructor was having to deal with this tricky question of what that meant. And he said, well, God created a temporary light. Well, there's nothing in Genesis that even hints that God created a temporary light. If everything was created in 6 days, and there, I went to the Creation Museum in Peterborough, Kentucky, this $25 million museum, where they have a replication of the Garden of Eden with dinosaurs. Because dinosaurs were in the garden, you could put saddles on them and ride them and stuff like this. And questions like, how did Noah get the dinosaurs on the ark? Well, Noah got them on the ark because they were baby dinosaurs. And why is it that T-Rex, because the dinosaurs and man, before the fall, dinosaurs were just plant eaters because everything was peaceful, but why did T-Rex have such big teeth? If he just ate plants, well, he had big teeth because he would crack open the coconuts with the teeth.
So just a quick follow-up. Do we need a reformation, and how would you like to lead it?
Do we need a reformation? I think we need the liberal church to get some spine and stand up. And I think we have to stop giving these people religious legitimacy and start denouncing them for the messages of hate that they wrap in the American flag and the Christian gospel. Right, where does the Catholic Church fall in that? That's a really interesting question, because I would go to these events, and this, of course, I think is endemic of what's happened in the movement, and you would see Catholic priests from Priests for Life and uniformed members of the Salvation Army and charismatics and Baptists all together in the same room. Now, many fundamentalists traditionally look at charismatics as Satan worshipers because they speak in tongues. I mean, the doctrinal disputes are not small. Anti-Catholicism, along with the anti-Semitism, along with the racism, still runs deep within conservative Christian circles. But what they've managed to do is unite these groups around this project of creating a Christian America so that these doctrinal or schismatic differences remain. But for now, they've been put on hold. Certainly, if they ever took power, if these radical dominionists took power, I don't think they'd have much time for the Catholic Church. Even when I took that seminar with D. James Kennedy, he referred to the Catholic Church as a cult, privately in the room. So they've drawn these conservative elements of the Catholic Church, along with charismatics, along with Pentecost, into the embrace of this movement to create a Christian America. But those differences remain. They remain virulent. They remain strong. And when you look at all radical movements, that's not uncommon. Go back and read the Russian Revolution. I mean, what happens is that once these forces achieve power, the most ruthless and the most vicious are the ones who rise up to the top. That's how Lenin got to where he was. And oftentimes they spend more time killing off their own than they do killing off anyone else because it is that scramble for power. Crane Britton wrote a lot about this in a great book, The Anatomy of a Revolution. The Christian Right in Iraq. Well, you know, what's happened in this country is, and this is unfortunately been mainstreamed for us by the Christian right, is that we speak about Muslims in a way that I think we could not speak about any other minority or ethnic group in this country. I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I spent 600 hours of my life studying Arabic. I mean, you know, Islam or the Muslim world constitute 1/5 of the world's population, most of whom, by the way, are not Arab. And the statements of ignorance and racism that are routinely put out against Muslims are ones that I think are very much fueled by the Christian right, which has demonized Islam and to our own detriment. You know, what radical movements do, just as radical Islamists, I mean, the radical Islamists, of course, are in many ways the mirror image of the Christian right. What they do is destroy the moderate center of their own societies. And the Christian right is working as hard to destroy the moderate center of our society, just as Islamic radicals are working hard to destroy the moderate center of their society, which is the majority, by the way, the vast majority. I mean, I lived in Egypt. I lived 7 years and traveled all throughout the Middle East. And what you're left with, which is what happened in the Balkans, are these two apocalyptic extremes who need each other. You know, Milosevic needed Tudjman, and Tudjman needed Milosevic. You know, one of the most interesting and disturbing things that we saw when we covered conflicts when they began is that the first people to be killed were not the radical members of the opposing ethnic group, because they need them. They need them to instill fear within their own, within your ethnic group. They were the members within your ethnic group who still reached out to the Muslims in the community, who still went over and had coffee with them, who still would visit the imam in the mosque. They were the first people to end up with a bullet through their head in the ditch, because they showed people another way to be, another way to speak, and another way to act, a way to hold together community. Those are the first people that get destroyed, and they get destroyed by their own.
Is there a fatwa from the Christian right on you now?
Not yet. I think that you know, the fringe element of this movement is frightening, and I think part of the reason people are hesitant to speak out about them is because people who come out of Christian Identity, Operation Rescue, and let's not forget about Blackwater and Eric Prince, the creation of America's Praetorian Guard, which is underway in Iraq right now. 25,000 American mercenaries. Eric Prince is a charter member of the radical Christian right, secretive, multimillionaire figure. What happened when Hurricane Katrina struck? Blackwater figures in black uniforms with automatic weapons and wraparound sunglasses showed up on the streets of New Orleans. What happens when there's a catastrophic terrorist attack in Washington and they throw this Praetorian Guard on the streets of Washington? Not accountable to anyone, outside of legal constraints. Look at what Christian Embassy is doing and other radical Christian groups are doing in the Pentagon. They're taking over all the chaplaincies. At least 50% now have fealty to non-denominational figures within the Christian right, and that's a form of indoctrination. It's a way of preaching to the military that their loyalty is to this Christo-fascist ideology and not to the democratic state. And in a moment of crisis, you know, when I travel to these mega churches, they are completely isolated from the community that they exist in. They don't reach out to other denominations. They don't reach out to the public schools. They could care less about the local officials. The only two groups they ever reach out to are law enforcement and the military. And that was a pattern that I kept seeing repeated in mega church after mega church after mega church. U.S. Marine Corps Appreciation Day, State Trooper Sunday, and they would bring these people in and laud them for their Christian probity. And they know very well what they're doing, that those forces of coercion within a society are absolutely fundamental if any radical movement is going to succeed. Thank you.
That was Chris Hedges on American Fascists, the Radical Christian Right. He spoke at the Boulder Bookstore in Boulder, Colorado, on January 22, 2007. Chris Hedges, a veteran foreign correspondent, is the author of American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Bill Moyers, Howard Zinn, George Lakoff, Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, and Gore Vidal. To access our vast audio catalog and to find out about subscribing to AR, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, tape, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Chris Hedges on American Fascists, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Thanks to the Boulder Bookstore and to Martin Folker for recording assistance. Allie Lightfoot edited the program. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.